You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Good evening. This is American Whiner. My name is Alex. I am back. I've been gone for a couple weeks. I took a vacation. It was great, and it's also great to be back. Well, I can say I've heard Herbie Hancock now. That was one of those names that, like, you just hear, and you know, when it comes to music, I knew he was a jazz musician, but I never actually heard anything that he'd ever done. And so, those of you who are listening on SoundCloud and didn't hear that song just now, that was the song Watermelon Man by Herbie Hancock. And the man who suggested that song as the intro is my guest tonight. His name is Chris Briest, and according to his Facebook page, this guy has multiple careers. He is like the busiest guy. He's a freelance audio sound engineer at 84 Frames and Get Super Rad. He does the sound at a Hard Rock Cafe Detroit. He used to be the entertainment director at the Plymouth Rock. He is an adjunct professor at Lawrence Technological University, although there is his actual position is something different than that, but we'll get into that. He's the senior director of repertoire at North Star Media, and he is the president at Plymouth Rock Productions. And it is great to have him here tonight. Mr. Chris Briest, thank you for being here. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, I always start off the show with the exact same question. We start right at the beginning, and that question is, where were you born?
I was born in Livonia, Michigan in 1981, apparently.
Okay. And tell me about your childhood. Did you grow up in Livonia, or did you...
I was there till I was 5 years old, and at the ripe old age of five, I moved to Plymouth, which is the town next door.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I didn't know this, but the reason my family had money to move was I was actually, when I was born, I was blinded in my right eye by the doctor. He stabbed me in the eye with the forceps.
Oh, my God.
So I'm legally blind out of my right eye, but you can't really tell.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I look weird enough anyways. So. So that was how my parents had the money to put the down payment on the house that I grew up. I found this out later when I was 18. And they told me what happened, but
okay.
I kept that kind of a secret from me at the time.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, so I moved to Plymouth when I was five, then started my education.
All right. What kind of a student were you in school?
I think I was a pretty good student, you know. I wasn't too wild until I think I got through junior high, and then I started kind of rebelling and being a little more of a asshole.
So what did your parents do for a living?
My mom was a stay-at-home mom, so she was, you know, I kind of was raised a mama's boy because she was around all the time. My dad worked in building materials, so he was a vice president for a company called Wimset Building Materials, which is still around.
Yeah, I've heard of Wimset. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was the roofing side of it.
Okay.
So yeah.
So you grew up in Plymouth primarily.
Mm-hmm.
How old were you when you first got interested in music?
I mean, I imagine just like everybody, you're kind of interested in it as soon as you hear it. Mm-hmm. As a kid, I remember like all the sort of stereotypical stuff of banging on pots and pans, and all of my like strongest memories were kind of auditory memories. I remember like going to Boblo when I was, I don't know, seven or something, and the pulling the steam horn, and I freaked out. And mm-hmm. It was like a strong memory. So maybe it has something to do with the fact that I was blinded.
I was about to ask you.
So
yeah,
that it made my... You know how they say your other senses will compensate for things. If you can't see, you get better hearing or taste or whatever.
So, yeah, yeah.
So I think maybe that had some sort of weird, you know, connection to that. But yeah, definitely grew up in that sort of space where it was.
So
all
you can't really pinpoint a moment where you were like, oh yeah, this is what I want to do, or
I definitely later on, like I think I got a guitar when I was like 14. My dad bought me a guitar, and I was really just, I mean, it, like you said, it, I don't know if there was a single moment that it kind of became something, but ever since I can remember, I was involved and interested in wanting to participate in it, and so I got a guitar, and then it was kind of like the next step of having an instrument.
Did you do anything in schools, music related, or?
No, I didn't. I wasn't in band. I didn't go into choir. I didn't do anything really. And I self-taught myself. I self-taught the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I didn't really take lessons until I was pretty deep into guitar and I started to want to branch out beyond, you know, whatever I was able to teach myself.
Well, tell me how you got your first guitar at 14 then. How'd that come about?
I think I must have been pestering my parents, you know, just starting on a mission to just you want something, and then you figure out any way to keep dropping the hint about the Red Ryder BB gun you want,
right,
or
right.
whatever. But yeah, I think it was just something that I'd just kind of been pushing, and then once I got my electric guitar, I kind of doubled down on everything and really started focusing more. And then I think when I was like 16, I got an acoustic guitar. It was mm-hmm. acoustic electric Yamaha APX something. And that was like another kind of step because I really took to the acoustic guitar for some reason. It really seemed to inspire me.
Did you start writing your own songs pretty much right off the bat? Or?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I was super – I mean, I grew up in the – you know, born in the 80s, so you're kind of like early 90s when the grunge stuff was hitting. I was like just starting to kind of come into my own, and so I loved Nirvana and all of those grunge bands. And then I also got into Dave Matthews Band.
Oh, hell yeah.
this is like before they became kind of like a huge – entity of it, you know, it's like its own thing.
Right, number one touring band and all that.
Yeah. So I got really into that stuff, and it was connected with the acoustic guitar, and I thought he was playing it in an interesting way because it seemed boring. First position chords, which is kind of an idiotic thing to think now that I look back, and it's like sort of important to play first position chords. But I was into, you know, just the way he worked around the neck with the guitar and did different things. So I totally became obsessed, learned how to play every single record, every song. And then at some point I kind of became aware of the fact that everything I was trying to write sounded like terrible versions of Dave Matthews songs. And then, you know, like I think anybody that's trying to take it seriously, you have to come to a point of being like, all right, these are my influences and this is amazing and I love these artists or this particular artist or whatever. But like you have to start finding your own voice within that, you know, take your influences, and instead of just trying to repeat that, is you mash it all together and try to find something that feels more authentic to who you are, and you know, I think that's a struggle for anybody trying to create music is to find that, you know, something that actually becomes more you than the sum of the parts and
exactly.
the influences, you know.
So did you start playing in bands pretty quick, or what was the first band that you played in?
So the first band I played in, I think I was 15. It was the, you know, Neighborhood Kids and my friend Andrew Nune and then his older brother Jeff, who was my babysitter at one point, and then we played in a band. The band was called Precision AD, which is an amazingly bad name. And I remember, like, we practiced and practiced and practiced and would talk about, you know, what the band meant, what we're doing. You know, it's like very Spinal Tap kind of thing of like just being so into something. But we played like two shows, I think, and we practiced for like 3 years.
Oh my God. What kind of music was it?
It's really hard to describe something that's so expansive from a creative standpoint.
Right.
But no, I mean, it was pretty terrible. It was just, I don't even know if it was cohesive enough to have a genre. It was just kind of four people playing music.
Just my first teenage garage band. Sounds,
yeah, exactly.
Like.
Yeah, yeah, Fisher Price, my first startup band.
So Precision AD goes on for your, sounds like for your high school years then?
Yeah, it was kind of, and it was something, again, that we didn't really play out. So people didn't even know I was in a band and, you know, it was like a private thing almost.
Mm-hmm. But you practiced a lot.
We practiced a ton, a lot of practicing. And so at some point, I want to say senior year, somewhere around there, we kind of, that band stopped happening, but I was really interested in just making records and got a Tascam 4-track and started recording. And some of the guys from that band and other people would get together and we'd come upon this mansion that my buddy was house-sitting for. So we made a little cassette album there that was like my first kind of experience recording stuff and trying to shape a thing, you know, like a record or a
right. So, well, so that was the very first time that you produced something then.
Yeah, that like. I was involved in
and
any
it was
way.
At a mansion?
It was at, well, so it was like a, to me it was a mansion again, uh-huh. But it was in Northville or Novi. It was like at 7 and Beck.
Okay.
So it was a big a pretty big house and had, you know, it was out and had a lot of land. It was beautiful and it was a spot, you know. It was
and amazing. you were 18, 19 years old then.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I was right around I think 17 18, 19, right in that age.
And so that's when, because that was going to be my next question. Tell me about the when you first got into wanting to produce and create music, record music rather than playing it.
Yeah, I imagine it's similar for most people that end up doing this is that you're just trying to find a way to record yourself mm-hmm. and to make your own songs. And then it grows from there and you learn and then you want to keep doing it. So you kind of expand to recording other people and just keep it's like a you know you catch the bug or whatever and you see how fun it can be and how much work it is at the same time and it's an interesting thing. It's not a it's very like nebulous sort of thing. It's not very linear where you just plug this microphone in, you do this and then these seven steps and you have a great song. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work like that. So it definitely caught my interest and it was something like I said that just essentially was a utility for me to be able to capture my own music and keep moving that forward. So
okay, so you're 18, 19 years old, and you've discovered that you want to record music. And so, did you start going to school for it, or what was the next step after that?
Yeah, so one thing I haven't ever been very well. I've told people about this, but part of this goes back to me being blinded when I'm. Fucking born. Mm-hmm. Can you say F word?
Yeah, we're good. This is okay. Internet radio, essentially. So
there's
yeah.
No FCC regulations.
Yeah, no, we're good.
It's amazing.
Say whatever the fuck you want.
Yeah, so I turned 18, and I've been really rabid about music. And at some point, my parents got divorced when I was 14. So this is important because my mom was kind of like, oh well, you know. Your dad, you got some money from that getting blinded, and he's – it's. I think it's like $40,000 or $50,000. And I was like, holy shit. To an 18-year-old kid, I mean, that might as well be like
– millionaire. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think he was hoping to wait till I was 18 and then he was going to kind of lay this on me. And my whole life, my parents had been like just crushing me on like work really hard and what would you do if you had little money and it didn't make sense until now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so my mom tells me this. I confront my dad about it and he's kind of mad because I think, you know, he wanted to do the unveiling. And so eventually I turn 18. My dad says, okay, we got to go to this meeting. You meet these lawyers and these people. So it turns out that this $40,000 that I got when I was 18 years later is worth like $285,000.
Holy shit.
Which is insane. You know what yeah. I mean? So like, I was like, what the fuck? And then I also immediately became super guilty because I was like, I didn't do anything for this. Yeah. Okay. I was blinded. Well, terrible things happen to people in birth and growing up and they don't necessarily get chunks of money.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was like, should I donate that? Should I just, you know, wash my hands of this and – you know, because there's people I know that don't have that much money and they work full-time their whole lives and, you know, they're retiring and they don't have that kind of money. So whatever, I got over this and I realized that I'm going to just use this money to really forward, like, my passion and try to pay it forward in any way that I can because if I can get this going, I can also help a lot of other people and not just myself and my own selfish endeavors. You know, it's something that I can kind of help out. And so that's what I did. And this is 1999. So when I went and met the investors, I was like, sell all the money and just take it all. And, you know, maybe I'll buy a Lamborghini or something. I don't know. I'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. And they convinced me not to do that because looking back, that's how they make money.
Right.
So anyways, $100,000 of it evaporated in 2001 essentially when it was in the market. So then I became really clear on like I don't want to invest in other companies in the stock market. I want to invest in my company or in my ideas because – when you're buying stocks, in a way, that's what you're doing. You're giving people money to help them try to fulfill their dreams. It's not as finite as that because it's big corporations. But it's kind of the idea.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So and that's what really, you know, helped me focus like a laser on it and not be like, whoa, shit, I got to go fucking make money to pay rent, or how am I going to eat, and or how many I had enough money to exist, and then I could spend all of my time hanging out with producers or interning at a studio 80 hours a week that I did and never got paid. Most people can't do that mm-hmm. because it's – I mean, I still got infuriated because I was like, I can't make any money. But that's part of the process you have to go through to be like – understand, like, yeah, you are worth money, then what are you going to fucking do? How are you going to make this work? You mm-hmm. know? So
you decided to use the money to fund your yeah. So what did you do then?
The breakdown was basically, if you say, okay, 18, I went from 285, I lost 100 grand in the market, I had $180,000. That's an incredible amount of money. I bought a truck. It was 20 grand, so 160. I went to Western Michigan, which was about 40 grand. So now you're down to 120. And from 18 to 23, I lived off of about $18,000 a year, $20,000 a year. And also in that period of time, I started a band and made a record, or got a record started. And basically by the time I was 23, all that money was gone. And it wasn't because I had, you know, blown it all, you know, doing drugs or traveling to Vegas. It was just, you know, living off of about 18-20 grand a year, which isn't that, you know, extravagant, and buying a car and going to college.
Well, you used it for what you wanted to and what you had to then.
Yeah, so, and yeah. It was amazing because it gave me an opportunity to do stuff that I really wanted to do, but I could accelerate that process to mm-hmm. where it might take somebody 3 years to do something because they have to work and save money and do blah, blah, blah. I could just do it right away, and it helped sort of allow me to jump certain levels in that business.
Okay. We're coming up on about 10 minutes before the break here, and I want to I definitely want to talk about your current endeavors because you have so much going on.
Sure.
But the first thing that I want to bring up is Plymouth Rock Productions, because that's mm-hmm. how I first met you.
Right.
So why don't you tell me how that came about?
So are you talking about the restaurant bar or the recording studio?
Well, I'm talking about the recording studio, but yeah. You can talk about the restaurant bar if you want.
So Plymouth Rock Productions, in this process, like I said, when I've been kind of working at studios and just putting all of my time and effort into the recording music world, I had made some really close friends working at the studio, and one of them was this guy, Peter Keys. And I was basically, again, leveraging what I had. I had a car, I had money. I started helping him drive around. He didn't have a license anymore. He was, you know, had hit the bottle a little too hard in his previous years. And through that, we became friends. And one day he had called me and told me about this place in Plymouth, which happened to be where I lived, and this old church he had found. I went there and quickly fell in love with the space because it's a fucking church and it's amazing. And the idea that that was in my town, and since I was like 17 years old, I'd always dreamed of having a place where we could, you know, it was like the hippie idea of like, oh, it's going to be a studio and we're going to be able to live there. And my friends, we're going to make music. And this kind of seemed like part of that dream, like actually in front of my face,
right,
in my town, not off somewhere far away. So
that was actually a church then. You got it as a church. I never knew that.
So it hadn't been a church for about 5 years. And when I showed up, the pastor's son was living in the basement with his wife, and my future business partner, Doug, had been renting the upstairs. And he was a retired guy, and he had like a photography thing set up and some amps, and he kind of just had a bunch of different things. It was kind of like a retirement bachelor pad fun house, you know, with a lot of toys, but there wasn't any focus. And then me and Pete showed up really with a kind of a laser on music and production, and then really started building the studio from there. And that was 15 years ago, I want to say.
So that would have been – I was going to ask the year when all that started. 2002.
Yep.
Okay. And so since then, the rest is history, as
yes.
they say, right?
Yeah. Like, so then we started slowly building a studio and grinding out and learning how to make a business out of, you know, something in the music industry, which is extremely hard. And part of it was that we consolidated everything. I moved into the basement of the church, and my drummer moved in there, and two other people did. So the rent income initially was what actually kept the place afloat. It wasn't that we're doing so many records and this and that. You know, that's usually the problem with those kind of businesses. You don't have cash flow. So the rent income from downstairs is what helped keep the place alive.
Yeah, it solved one of your main problems right off the
bat. Cash flow, yeah. And it allowed us to take our time and grow and not try to force everything, and slowly built up from there and started making more records. I started working a lot on film and TV crews, which I really made some good money doing that, field audio and whatnot, and then mixing and making my own record at that time.
And then you just – and so Plymouth Rock was where you kind of – the spearhead, and then it just branched out. Everything else that you're doing now kind of came from that.
That gave us – gave me kind of like a home base, a terrestrial physical space that people could come and see. And it does help you in some ways just by sheer fact that there is a physical place people can go and see, like, oh, here's a studio. Not – I'm an audio engineer and – I can come to your studio and work, or I can, you know, you can have all the same skill set, but without a physical place, it's really hard to get people to connect the dots and understand, oh, that's the guy with the music, the studio, you know, that sort of thing. So,
well, it's a beautiful studio too.
Yeah, it's really come along, and you know, the big thing that helped us go from whatever level we were at to the level we're at now is partnering up with Lawrence Tech, which was something that happened in 2008. I was flying out to the X Games. I met a lady that worked there, and through some very serendipitous things, like, I ended up starting a program there, and we've been doing that for like 9 years now.
Yeah, why don't you tell me about the – because it says you're on your Facebook page you're an adjunct professor, but you were telling me there's more to it than that.
Yeah, the reality is that I serve as like the founder and director of this entire bachelor's program, which is – really been an amazing thing because we started it with no money and it was kind of an experiment and had one kid in it, and now we have 40 some kids in the program. And the biggest thing to me is that the outcomes are successful, where, you know, somebody's going through our program, coming out and getting a job in the audio engineering field at companies like Harman or Panasonic, where they actually get actual jobs in the sense of there is a 401k, they're making more than $5,000 a year.
They can make a living, right?
They can make a real living. You know, there's people that are graduating and signing $70,000, $75,000 contracts with a real company. And that, to me, was inspiring in and of itself, because what I always see is just like the struggle of trying to make records and do all these things. And even, you know, last year we put out a number one record with Royce da 5'9", this hip-hop artist. And those were things I always thought would be like, well, if you just could make number one records, it would be – that's it. Then it's all just – and it's not. It's so depressing to think that like we put out a fucking number one record and, yeah, it paid us some money, but it wasn't – you know, it's not like we're driving around in Maseratis and
– got to keep moving. Got to keep focused on the next thing.
Yeah.
And so while all this is going on, you're still making music then too, right?
Yeah. So I had started a band with my a bunch of my close friends, and it actually started to get some momentum where, you know, we had this Peter Keys guy who had played with George Clinton, and he's now in Lynyrd Skynyrd. He's the keyboardist for Lynyrd Skynyrd now. So I lost my keyboardist to Skynyrd, but.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah, it's always the worst. But he got involved. Some other really great people got involved, and we made this record. And even though it didn't on paper make me millions of dollars or do anything, the process of making that record, the people and the networks that I created, that almost every single one of my jobs are connected to, came from some direct or indirect way of me working on my record and making my record. Either people that were fans of my music that hired me to do stuff when we became friends, or people that were directly helping me make the record. And it's amazing because in a way that was a successful record, because it helped me take these next steps to where I'm still surviving and working in the industry. Right, and we got some songs on TV shows and all those things. It was great. And that's how I got involved with North Star Media. I was signed as an artist initially in the late 2000s. And at some point, I started working for the company. And now I'm their senior director of repertoire services.
What is that exactly?
North Star Media is a music publishing company.
Oh, okay.
So their job is to exploit copyrights that they control or own. And they do this by licensing it in TV, film, and advertising, by pitching to song plugging, basically finding any way they can to sort of exploit the copyright. It doesn't sound so nice, but it's good. It means they're making money for the artist and themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do at that company is I'm in charge of all of the assets, all of the music, making sure the metadata is correct, making sure the processes of how the songs get ingested into our system and how the whole thing flows from being pulled into our system, being put onto our databasing systems, and then the front-facing website where we actually deliver assets to music supervisors, who are the people who place music in film, TV, and advertising.
Okay. Man, you know, we only have an hour for these shows, and I always wish we had more time because there's so much to get into.
Yeah, yeah.
But coming up on a break here, so I'll just ask you real quick, what do you got coming down the pipeline the next, year, couple months?
Yeah, so right now we're actually I've just signed another contract with Lawrence Tech, and we're building a second recording studio in the basement.
Oh, wow.
So in the basement is where we used to live, like I said, where we had all these tenants and kind of, helped to support that place, but we've gutted that whole basement. It's empty now, and we're working with a guy named Glenn Brown, who's a big studio designer, and basically I'm in the middle of that project right now. So that's my main focus, is designing, building, and sort of general contracting the whole thing.
And getting that up and running. When's that going to be functional?
My initial plan was to have it functioning and completed by August. Uh-huh. And, being that we're here in the first part of July, and I still haven't really put up any construction yet other than tearing down stuff. So September, October.
Somewhere this fall, you're thinking?
I'm hoping this fall and not in the fall of like 2022.
Yeah.
But you can't force it. You have to follow the order operations. As much as I'd like to just start building, you got to wait.
Right. You got to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, cool. Well, we're going to take a quick 10-minute break here. I'm going to play some more music for you. And if you're listening to this on stream, we'll be back in a matter of seconds. So here is the second song that Chris picked out for the show. This is David Bowie and
The Gene Genie.
The Gene Genie. And we will see you in 10 minutes. Talking about... American Whiner, we are back for the second half with Mr. Chris Briest. So we were talking over the break, and when you first got here, you were like, man, I hate whining. Like, I don't want to.
I do hate whining.
I don't really have anything to whine about. And we've encountered this before. There's nothing wrong with it. There's absolutely nothing wrong with not wanting to whine. That just means you're an adult, as I said. but over the break, we came up with a really interesting topic that we have not broached yet, and that is renters, people renting space from you and all the shit that must come with that. So
yeah,
I'm going to let you take it away.
More specifically, in my case, recording studio renters in the basement.
Yep. Yes, that's an incredible combination of words there that would make renting even more, crazy than it would normally be.
Yeah, and something about the music industry and just the creative world in general is just like this massive pool of degenerates,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which I consider myself one of too.
Oh,
it's
me
not
too.
Like
yeah.
I'm not saying it in a negative way necessarily, but it was truly amazing because at least in our situation, we had this old church. The upstairs was a recording studio.
Yeah, plus this is an old church. This is occurring between below a space where only were years before people were worshiping God.
It was deconsecrated, so nobody could get too upset about us, shitting on the Lord or anything. but it was amazing because, like you said, it's A, it's an old church. B, there's a recording studio there. And C, now we had four apartments down there. And everything was communal. So you have a bedroom, and that's the only part of this whole space that is yours. The living room shared, the kitchen shared, the shower. The shower we had, you had to walk up steps to a raised shower that drained into the sink of the kitchen.
Oh, my God.
So and the sink also was the drain for the washing machine. So you had the washing machine draining into the sink. You had the shower drain not into the top part of the sink, but into the bottom drain part.
Right, right.
So it was truly just a cesspool of degenerates and an actual cesspool where there was, just filth everywhere. and it was the basement of an old church. So you got the creepy factor. It was tough to sell to bring beautiful baby bunnies back.
Well, you just tore out all the apartments, put in a second studio, as we were talking about. How long then? It was 15 years or so that you said that you had.
Years.
So how many people came and went through all that time?
I want to say about a dozen over the time. And you know, it's just one of those things. I'm sure for anybody that rents to tenants, it's a little strange, especially if you also live there.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing if you're like, well, fuck these guys. They can just destroy their lives and I don't have to see it as long as they pay rent and they don't burn the place down or do any massive, you know, damage to my thing. I don't care. But I actually lived with these fucking people.
Yeah, so you had to experience it with them.
Yeah, and you experience every little quirk about personalities or, you know, artists don't – they don't tend to be very wealthy individuals. And so paying rent is a problem. You know, the people they bring around is can be a problem. One of the last people we had was a bouncer at a restaurant I frequent, and – he happened to move in. I tried to keep it all musicians and stuff because a lot of people thought it'd be cool to live in a studio. Not so cool when, you know, you got a 9 to 5 and like at 4 a.m.
Right.
There's
right.
a rager going on and, you know, we're air guitaring and playing fucking the Gene Genie.
Mm-hmm.
But I always couldn't handle just the when it became a money thing because I hate fucking asking people for money. Even if I know you owe me money or whatever, it's just the worst. I fucking hate it. I hate dealing with money and commerce and especially if you're friends with the people too and you know they're having a hard time and then, okay, well, hey, we'll just – don't worry about this right now. But at some point it
but
becomes
I need
a
it
fucking
at some
problem.
Point. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Then it becomes like, oh, well, what you now I'm paying for it.
Yeah.
If somebody doesn't pay for something, whether it's even I'm making a record, you know, people – that's another thing we can bitch about is people not understanding what the fuck making records is and thinking like, oh, me and my band, we're going to come in. We need 4 hours. We only got an hour of music. We're going to play it. It's going to be perfect. And it's like, well, you have to set up the mics and you have to fucking track it. And then you have to listen back to the shit. So even if it's an hour and you listen to it twice, that's 2 hours of listening. Then you make your edits and you know, people don't appreciate fucking time and money.
Well, I guess that's a really great idea. But before we get in, we can definitely get into the musicians
yes.
and the biggest pain in the ass when it comes to people not understanding what goes into making a record. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you, what is your biggest pet peeve when it comes to just renting out apartments? Like,
it's just the fucking money. Mm-hmm. I mean, and there's been a couple cases where the personality of the people becomes just insufferable. You know, I just can't deal seeing your stupid fucking face for another second. And I would just hide into my bedroom and just pray that somehow like they'd be struck by lightning or something. And I love these people. I mean, it's terrible to say that, but I genuinely just didn't want them fucking to be near me. But you live together. I mean, that's kind of the nature of.
Yeah, that's just kind of something that happens when you're around somebody too much. You know, that happens to, you know, bands on tour buses.
Exactly.
And,
it could be anybody.
You know, close quarters. When all of your water is draining into the same place, there will eventually be drama.
There's a lot of collusion.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything. But yeah, we had this particular roommate. We'll call him Mr. Smoothie because you know who I'm referring to. And Mr. Smoothie was like this fucking dude that just didn't know how to show up into a room or a space and not make it about him. Like he had to grab the attention of the room. He just couldn't help it. It was like a fucking disease that he had. And the only prescription was more fucking attention. You know, it was like the cowbell thing. Got a fever. And this dude would straight up, you know, we'd come back from the bar at 2 a.m. He wouldn't drink, so he'd be just there waiting, fucking percolating, waiting to get up into our shit. And we'd come back and have a couple friends with us, maybe a couple girls. And he'd be welcome to come in and hang out. But he would do shit like we're watching TV or talking or doing whatever. He'd bring in a bass amp into the room. I mean, there's nobody playing music. It's not a jam session that he's joining. He brought a bass amp downstairs, not in the studio part, into the living quarters and just set it up and starts playing bass. Like, this isn't even like a good – oh, he's playing a beautiful guitar riff, and this is cool. He's kind of background.
This is like the one instrument that – well, the only thing that would have been weirder is if he brought drums into the communal space and started playing
the drums. But even drums, like, I feel like I could pay attention to drums a little more. Then I could fucking a bass boom 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 boom, yeah. Boom 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 boom. I mean, there's no what the fuck
it
are you doing?
It just dominates the conversation in the
and
worst possible way.
And it's just insane. Yeah. It's fucking insane. Like, who does? And he literally did this. And I had to just. I didn't even talk to him. I just got up. I unplugged the bass amp and I carried the bass amp back to his room. And I didn't even say anything. I was just like, "This is we can't do this."
What did
you
he do? Did he just like look at you or? Did
he just like, "Oh, okay," you know. And then he went and did his bassing in this room. But he learned how to juggle. He would come out and start juggling. He'd be doing poi fucking stuff. I mean, amazing dude. I love him to death. But there were parts that just. Fucking insufferable.
Oh, jeez. Well, okay, so why don't you tell me about a time when a band came in where a client came in and just didn't
I wouldn't say it. A time. I'd say more often than not.
Oh, okay, well, perfect.
People
even
just
better.
Don't fucking know. And it's understandable and to some extent because they're ignorant because they haven't maybe done it before. Or, I mean, I came from the same world where I just want – you want it to be done. You want it to be magical. You want all these great things to happen. You want everybody to tell you it was perfect. And the reality is it's not like that. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of second-guessing yourself, a lot of not feeling necessarily like, was this the right take? Is this the right direction? Is this the right song?
Mm-hmm.
And it's fucked up and it's ugly and it's not – you know, but people want – they don't want to deal with that. They want the – they want the producer, in my case, to be like, oh, well, once we cut this, man, I'll tell you what.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just – it's fortune and glory from here on out. Just finish this vocal. Give me that $5,000 and it's going to be amazing. That's what they want. They want to be told the fucking
– they're going to be stars, right? Yeah.
Yeah. They want to be told the lie.
I will say that I did my first three EPs with you guys way back in 2011 and 2012, and we churned those things out. And I will say,
plug the band name, please.
The Primitive Shine was the name of the band. It's still together, but I won't go into that. I talked about that on my first show briefly, but I did notice, though, especially with what you just said, the very first EP that we did was done in like a day. Mm-hmm. And the third one, which was done about a year later, took us 6 months or so.
Yeah.
So we were learning as we went.
And it's okay. It's a process a lot of times. And that's why I try to tell people and they look at me kind of cross-eyed like, well, what the fuck does that mean? I'm like, it means that it's not necessarily all going to happen right now. You may not – it's just not necessarily going to all be there. It's not going to be this great thing. It's something you work at and you keep striving for. And then maybe somewhere down the line you actually make a recording that people feel and they actually respond to. And,
right, right.
And that's just not an easy thing. I mean, if you imagine all the successful bands in the world, they already supposedly know how to do this. And they can't fucking replicate it. They can't make – the same record they made last year and it work again. It just doesn't, you know.
Well, it's an interesting thing because, like, you know, I still record and I know – I learned long ago that, you know, when you're a kid, you totally buy into it. Like you said, they want you to say – oh yeah, you guys are going to be fucking famous for this. This is the most brilliant thing I've ever heard. You're the next whatever it is you want to be. And that in itself is a complete bullshit lie that they are sold by the culture.
Yeah, and it's something also I think that we want to believe. We want to believe that there's this magic fucking road to riches and to – and the reality is you want to be good, great at something. You want to make a lot of money. I'd say 99.99% of the time that requires a ton – a fuck ton of work and commitment and dedication and failure and struggle and all that shit.
Yeah.
And just nobody wants to hear that.
Yeah. No, and it's something you can't even sum up in like any sentence either. No. It's just – it has to be lived. And I learned – I remember because like I said, I still record – for me, it's about prioritizing and setting goals. And the goal, like you said with the record that you made that ended up leading to everything else that you did, that you're doing now, It's the to make it exist is the goal. And once it exists, then you've succeeded in that thing, and then you move on to the next thing. And maybe it leads somewhere, but at a certain point you learn to not worry about that because it's not going to get you anything.
And it doesn't end when you finish that record or that session or that song or anything. It's part of a bigger process known as your life. Mm-hmm. And that's you know, what you're doing more than like setting these little nav points in like, oh, well, today I graduated high school. Yes, that's great. Mm-hmm. But that's part of now the next step in your life. And it's always a process. And that's why I always preach sort of the thinking about it in that way to people, because that way you can't get too high or too low when things fall apart or when great things happen to you in your career, that you understand this is just part of the journey and it's not the end all be all.
That's fucking beautiful. I'm glad we talked about this. So we got 10 minutes left. Is there any other crazy stories that you have? You must have a whole bunch of them, 15 years, you know, worth of stuff, both tenants and musicians.
The most crazy experience I've had in the last, I'd say, at least musically speaking, in the last couple of years was working with this gentleman, Royce 5'9", who put out a record, Layers, last year and was number one for a week on Billboard and iTunes until Drake released his record.
So, oh, that bastard Drake.
Fucking asshole thought he was going to, you know, have a $12 million marketing campaign that would beat out Royce's, you know, indie marketing campaign, which means there's no money to it. But but no, this guy, he's in recovery, so he doesn't drink or party in any sort of way that, you know, you could imagine. And he came back to the studio and we started working on this record, and I've never experienced this, but this guy would do sessions that lasted days, and there was no break. He didn't eat. He didn't, you know, he went to the bathroom once in a while and people were like, well, what the fuck is this dude? And it was like, he's on music is what he's on. Uh-huh. And that's, you know, his focus. I've never seen anything like this. We did a 22-hour session. I was like, wow, that was crazy. You know, I burned through a couple engineers, and then he came back and did like a 32-hour session. And I'm like, oh, this is getting. And it ended up where the last marathon session we did was 55 hours.
Holy fuck.
So
that's a work week with overtime.
And he literally did this straight.
Yeah.
It wasn't 55 hours in a week. It was 55 hours from when he walked in the building to when he left the building. And I shit you not, I don't know if we got him food. I mean, all he had was water. There was no – and people would be like, there's no way. You know, he's doing something. He's on his, and I don't care who you are. You can't do drugs for 55 hours.
Yeah.
Like at some point, like it just fucking – you can't.
Well, that
not
makes me wonder.
Crack or cocaine or meth or whatever. Like
you're going to get burned out.
I think – you know, in my mind, what he was doing was that was his drug.
Exactly. That's what I was about to say. Yeah. I was going to say, like, I wonder if him being in recovery, he's, I don't want to say running from it necessarily, but that's what he's like. I have to focus intensely. I have to be addicted to something. And if I have to be addicted to something, I'm going to pick music.
Well, so. And I remember even back when he was, when he was not in, you know, when he was drinking and whatnot. And he would still go later and longer than anyone else. So he already had that kind of in his DNA. But it was like once you took those like things that were maybe holding him back from really going crazy off of him, he just went far deeper into the rabbit hole.
And it fucking worked. He went to number one.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it worked. And it's just, you know, it's also just the nature of who he is. Like. The reason he's so good is because he genuinely – all he wants to do is be in the fucking studio. That's all he wants to do. He doesn't want to do it so that he can go then and play a show. He doesn't – I don't think he's really that big of a fan of touring. It's all about being in the studio and creating for him. And he is so much more rabid than any other motherfucker that's come in and be like, oh, I'm so serious about music. I want to do this. But it's like, all right, well, sit in there for 55 – just stand up for 55 hours.
Yeah, exactly. Do anything for 55 hours straight.
If you can do that, then maybe – you know, that these are the people that succeed, and this is why, because they're crazier than you are. Mm-hmm. They're willing to go deeper and longer, and they have skills that you don't have. Mm-hmm. But they're going to work so much fucking harder than you and anybody else, and that kind of – shows you, you know, what the difference is between those people and everybody else.
Right, right. Well, say his name again, because I'll be honest, I haven't heard of him. But
no, his name's Royce59. He was the only guy on Eminem's first record, which is I think My Name Is or whatever.
There was a Shady LP.
There was a song called Bad Meets Evil or Bad Versus Evil, and it's Eminem and Royce going back and forth. Then they created a group called Bad Meets Evil, and they put out a record in 2012, I believe, which is just M and Royce battling in these songs, which is fucking incredible. Shit. And when we heard that record, I thought it was going to just take over the world. And for whatever reasons, most people don't even know about it.
Yeah. But, everybody knows D12, but I'll be honest, I hadn't heard of that. I will definitely look it up now, though.
Yeah, Royce has been involved in a ton of stuff. He's ghostwritten from everybody from Dre to P. Diddy. And he's a serious force if you look him up and you realize – who he is in that world. And honestly, you and me aren't huge hip-hop heads, but anybody who knows anything knows who that guy is.
That's how good it is. It's like, even if you don't, if you're not familiar with this genre of music, you still know what this is about.
Yeah.
You will listen to it and get it.
Mm-hmm.
So how old is he then? He must be in his 40s, I would assume.
He's 38, I want to say, 39, something like that.
Okay, so approaching 40, yep.
But yeah, he came up with M. They were kind of in the same space, and again, if you know anything, if you know and study M or any of the people around that, Royce is involved and threaded into that DNA from the very beginning.
Yeah, well, if he was on his very first album, then,
yeah, he's,
you know,
the only other guy on there.
Yeah,
is M and featuring Royce59 on one track. And
wow,
he's
man.
In Slaughterhouse, which is another big Detroit group, and he's just a prolific writer. He just. Like I said, that's all he wants to do. He can't, you know, it's just who he is.
Well, do you have anything else to add, Chris, as we wrap the show up here?
No. I think I've
got it all out of your system.
I think I'm pretty wined out at this point. You know, maybe I could try a little more Crown, and that can help make the whining feel not so painful.
Grease the skids a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being here, man. I had a great time talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great seeing you again.
Yeah, you too. I was trying to remember the last time we saw each other, and I couldn't remember. That's how long it's been.
Yeah,
it's been six, seven years.
Fucking minute, for sure.
But so glad you came in, and so I'm back on the regular schedule now. I actually have an announcement to make. I'm going to try and do this weekly from now on. I'm going to still do the musician thing every other week, but I want to start doing it every week, and on the off weeks I want to just have my buddies and friends in here, and we will not interview each other. We'll just fucking bitch, which is what we do anyway. So anyway, thank you all for listening. I will, if I'm not back next week, I'm going to talk to the owner and hopefully I get something set up. But if not, I will be back a week from next Monday with another guest. This is American Winer. My name is Alex. Thank you so much for listening.